Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Cecil Stockwell Jr. et al., appellants versus Lloyd Stockwell, appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Sean Nichols, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, also an attorney from Sioux Falls. Once in a while, very close to consideration of a case, when we're going through the record, we come across what was not known previously to be a disqualification of a justice that happened in this case. And so Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself, and we did not have sufficient time to bring in a replacement. By tradition, we will go with the four justices, and if there is a 2-2 tie, we will bring in a circuit judge to become the tiebreaker. So, any questions, gentlemen? Okay, if not, then Mr. Nichols, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, members of the Supreme Court. On behalf of my clients, first, thank you for the opportunity to present our case. I want to start by specifically talking about Exhibit 33, page 2, which is in the record. It's a letter dated February 24, 2004. It was attached to correspondence from Tom Johnson's office to Jason Harris, who was an attorney for my clients at the time. It's a letter from Lloyd Stockwell. It says, "To whom it may concern, Cecil Sr.'s current operation, his farm operation, is losing money. Changes must be made to alter this. I will no longer continue to go into debt for him. I feel I should reap the fruits of my labor and not my father nor my brothers. It is time that I receive compensation for my labor and investment." That's the words of Lloyd Stockwell in February of 2004, explaining his view of his father's farmland and his belief that, really belief of entitlement and the problem with that, and in Trial Exhibit 33 as well, you'll see a breakdown of the farm operation, expenses, assets, that type of thing that Lloyd had prepared. And that was to rebuff questions in a guardianship action that had been started by my clients over concerns about their father's finances. And you fast forward a year before, there was a meeting between the four brothers who are party to this lawsuit and questions about Lloyd wanting to go to a bull sale in Montana and asking my three clients to each give them $115 so that their father could be put in a nursing home for a few days while he attended the sale. Well, that raised red flags with my clients wondering, well, what's going on? Our dad has plenty of money. He doesn't need us to pitch in. They do investigation. They find out that taxes on the farmland have not been paid for some 5 years. They have real concerns about, in case the record isn't clear at this point, Cecil Sr., the father, is living with Lloyd Stockwell at the time. And so this prompts this guardianship action and this letter that I had just read. We're here today principally on three issues. It's an issue of whether farm deeds, the deeds to the roughly 900 acres of land, were actually delivered, as South Dakota law defines delivery. There's an issue of whether Cecil Sr. had the capacity at the time he delivered the deeds. And then the third issue is whether there was an exercise of undue influence. The trial court found, actually Lloyd Stockwell started this action as a quiet title action. We made a counterclaim to cancel the instruments and also breach of fiduciary duty and some claims for money damage, which were resolved. And so this matter was tried to Judge Bjorkman over 2 days. Approximately a year ago, April of 2009. So that's how we get here. Judge Bjorkman found that the deeds were effective and quieted title in favor of Lloyd. We believe the trial court erred for a number of reasons. As we march through what must be considered today, I'm mindful of the 1994 case by this court, it's First National Bank versus Bank of Lemon. And I think it's critical in this case because in that case this court held, while the trial court is afforded some deference in seeing the live testimony and reviewing what the witnesses have to say, this court reviews de novo the tangible exhibits. I think that's important here because we have 50-some, maybe 60 exhibits that Judge Bjorkman considered as he prepared his findings of fact and conclusions of law, which this court can review de novo. What I think is significant is that many of the exhibits that I think are compelling and were strong evidence in our case for undue influence, capacity, and lack of delivery were ignored in the 42 pages of findings of fact and conclusions of law. And so even though they were very detailed, there were a number of things that just didn't find its way into the record, were never addressed by the trial court. And I think if this court looks at that de novo, we'll see the error in failure to look at those. I want to talk first about delivery. There's a couple of questions as to when delivery occurred that we've raised in our materials. To give you some sense of the shock that I had as we're progressing toward trial, there's a motion for summary judgment that we made based on capacity because Lloyd Stockwell's interrogatory answers, which were trial exhibit 72, initially indicated that these deeds were delivered to him in July of 2004. And at the time, he had just moved his father into a nursing home. And in exhibit 69, which I've taken the language straight from the nurse's note and included in our initial brief, indicates that within a couple days of when he was delivered to the nursing home, Cecil Sr. didn't know what day it was, where he was. The nurse notes that both long and short-term memory severely impaired. He thought he was in Brandon, but most significantly, he needed several attempts to remember who his children were. So we're looking at that type of mental condition within...
Trial court found he was competent even then. Is that right?
True. And that's where I think we go back to this First National Bank case. If you look at the actual exhibits themselves, I think that whether 2004, 2001, the trial court was wrong. That note, for one, I think it's very telling of that. But also, there's the Tom Johnson video, which is trial exhibit 82, I believe. This court has at its disposal.
Well, those notes were introduced, but the witnesses who wrote the notes were not called, were they?
That's correct. And I know that Judge Bjorkman, the trial court, was somewhat concerned about the fact that the actual witnesses themselves didn't come in and say, well, he was competent or he wasn't competent. Our argument has always been, well, rather than call 40 nurses to talk about their daily notes, we can look at the notes and see what they say. So if somebody makes an observation that his long and short-term memory is impaired, that he can't recall his children without prompting, that's not so much an issue that somebody's coming in and saying, well, he's competent or not. They're just making an observation, an objective observation, and I think those notes from that standpoint do have important clues for us as to the question of capacity. Also, there's a myriad of other facts that were really undisputed about Cecil Sr.'s problems forgetting things that really round out the Exhibit 69 and Exhibit 82, which is the Tom Johnson video.
Well, usually the testimony or capacity is generally a question of fact. I can only think of one case in the last 30 years where the court has disposed of this type of a case on a summary judgment review, and there the Supreme Court affirmed the trial court in the Mary Nelson case, so I don't ever recollect us doing what you're asking us to do today.
Well, and maybe I come in second on that issue, but this court has before it a video. It is the only objective evidence of what Cecil Sr., what his mental firepower was, long before these deeds were supposedly delivered. Now, I want to transition to delivery here in a moment. Again, I think beauty's in the eye of the beholder. This court can review that video de novo, and clearly Cecil Sr. on that video doesn't know how old he is. He doesn't know how much land he has. He can't recall the name of his favorite grandchild. There were no questions asked of him as to what his children's name were, so that issue, I think, is not addressed. But you look at that, and the fact that he thinks he has 300 acres of land, doesn't know that he's signed these deeds, just remembers signing them, doesn't know what the purpose was. Those are some pretty important clues in my mind as to the capacity issue. But it raises a larger question as to when the deeds were delivered. Now, we have testimony under oath from Lloyd Stockwell saying they were delivered in July of 2004. Then he changes his testimony after we move for summary judgment and says, no, I actually received them in September of 2001. And I think that's important because it shows, first of all, that he's got volatile testimony, shows some untruthfulness to his testimony as to delivery, and it also opens up this whole Pandora's box as to what exactly his account of how these deeds came to be. For me, the big issue there is the tax consequences. It was undisputed at the trial court level that Cecil Sr. said to Lloyd, these are not to be filed because of tax consequences. And in fact, Judge
Burke... Right. Well, you can have delivery without filing of a deed, however.
Oh, certainly. But there was no gift tax filed in 2001. Our standard in South Dakota for delivery is plucked almost straight out of the IRS standard as to when a gift takes place for taxable consequences. And because there was no gift tax filed, and in fact, Judge Bjorkman in his findings of fact stressed at great level that there was some testimony by Dale Strasser that in 1996 Cecil Sr. wanted to somehow transition some of the land that Lloyd eventually received into Lloyd's name, but couldn't do it because of the tax basis. He paid so little for the land that there would be a 65% of the stepped-up basis would be a taxable consequence. But what changed in 2001 where that still wasn't an issue? And so I think that the trial court's findings of fact are actually inconsistent in that regard, because he says, well, the deeds were delivered in 2001, but they had problems in 1996 because of tax consequences. So why would Cecil Sr. all of a sudden in 2001 want to complete delivery? Well, he couldn't. And if you look at Exhibit 47, it's the plaintiff's exhibit from John Winandy, the tax expert. I mean, clearly indicates that there was no gift tax return filed at all. And if our standard for delivery comes straight from the IRS regulations, and I cited 26 CFR 25.2511 in our brief, if our standard comes straight from the IRS regulations saying this is a taxable consequence, there should be a gift tax return in order for that delivery to take place. Also,
but people every day execute gifts and don't follow the required returns. I mean, it doesn't follow that just because you don't file a gift tax return that you didn't make a gift.
I understand that. Also, though, the certificate of value for the deeds wasn't completed until July of 2004, which I think is also telling of the question of the tax basis and what would be taxable, either under state or federal law. So that's another issue. Also, the whole idea that these deeds were prepared in September of 2001, you know, massive changes in the law on both the state and federal level in July of 2001. At the time, Cecil Sr. was a shut-in. He wasn't watching TV, he wasn't watching the news, had basically no contact with the outside world. And yet, we have these deeds that give Lloyd several hundred more acres of land. They're executed a few months later. The facts here, they kind of weave through all the legal issues, but also is suggestive of undue influence as well. I want to talk about some of the exhibits that the trial court ignored in his findings. Exhibit 8.
I got to stop you right there because, I mean, ignored is kind of a strong word. Just because the court doesn't mention explicitly, identify something in a finding, doesn't mean they ignored it. I mean, you certainly presented it to the judge. I just have trouble saying that that's ignoring evidence.
And I apologize if...
I mean, I think to satisfy your standard, there'd have to, the findings, which are really lengthy in this case, would have to be five times longer in order to explicitly mention every single thing that happened in the course of a lengthy trial.
Well, I would respectfully disagree. There were five exhibits that could have been addressed that really weren't. Exhibit 8 is a Dale Strasser memo. That was the time that Lloyd Stockwell came to Dale Strasser in the fall of 2003 to talk about this guardianship action that had been started, and he's makes a number of observations. One of the things he says is that, well, can you help me sell 220 acres of land? Well, guess what? That's all that my clients received out of these deeds. Dale Strasser, I believe it's on page 72 of the second day of the transcript, said unequivocally what Lloyd meant when he came in 2003 was he wanted to sell the 220 acres from the 2001 deed and end up going to my clients. Lloyd says, no, I was talking about something else in 1995. That's his testimony, his version of things. But Dale was unequivocal that, you know, he's talking about this 220 acres that were in the 2001 deeds, not addressed in the findings of fact.
All right. Under South Dakota law, there's if a deed is given to a person and that person is to receive the land, there's a presumption of delivery, is there not?
I agree that the presumption is a correct statement of South Dakota law. Where I disagree with that, though, is in the Nelson case, which we cite in our brief. In order for there to be delivery, all control and all power over those deeds has to be relinquished. I disagree that there was a relinquishment of control here. Under either, if you look at Exhibit 72, Lloyd's complete interrogatory answers, both the initial and the second set, very detailed. I got these deeds in 2004, and then later, no, it's 2001. Tom Johnson testified in this case, and I mean, he had multiple conversations with Lloyd about when he received these deeds. In fact, their first office conference, Tom Johnson's notes indicate, they talked about the lady who even notarized the deeds. And so, I mean, it was not a surprise at all to Tom Johnson. Lloyd had this account that he got him in 2004, and then the story changes as we progress. And I think it's significant that we have this volatile account when there's quite a foundation that Tom had. I mean, he even, in April of 2004, researched gift tax issues.
Correct. Judge Bortman considered all this. And so what you're asking us to rule is what? That he was abuse of discretion? Or what are you saying that are clearly erroneous?
I believe that there was no delivery as a matter of law because Cecil Sr. never relinquished full control over the deeds.
Isn't that a question of fact?
I think the facts are settled. The facts are what they are. It's a determination for this court to make whether or not he relinquished control. I don't see how he could have. And so I think that's a matter of law. Second of all, as to the capacity issue, I think the record's replete with evidence that this court can review de novo that he did not know the full nature and extent of his bounty prior to 2004, when I believe...
But what, is there any question of his capacity in 2001?
There was testimony from my clients that they didn't believe that their father had capacity in 2001. There was testimony in the record that, for example, 2 months before these deeds were prepared, that Cecil Sr. forgot that his own brother had even died in July of 2001. So there's certainly testimony to that effect. I would concede that the issue is a lot tougher under a 2001 analysis as it would be under 2004, because this court is without the benefit of any exhibits during that time frame. Where here, if we look at 2004, you have the exhibits 69 and 82, which I think are telling as far as capacity goes. Again, talking about the exhibits that the trial court didn't place stock in, which I think this court should. If we look at Exhibit 87 and 83, Exhibit 83 is a check that Lloyd wrote out of his father's account to hire Tom Johnson to represent him. Well, first he wrote a check to out of his dad's account to his own account, and then to Tom Johnson to pay a retainer. So, I mean, he's clearly using his father's money for his own purposes. Exhibit 18 has a check for $10,900 to Minnehaha County that Lloyd wrote out of his father's account to pay his own property taxes. Again, using his dad's account for his own benefit.
The trial court, you say, did not deal with those issues?
Not addressed in the findings at all. Exhibit 87, which I talked about for a little bit. This is getting back to that Dale Strasser memo and the 220 acres. That's a lease agreement that was between Bruce Stockwell, who's here with me in the courtroom today, and his father that Lloyd had prepared or had his wife prepare, indicating that this lease of 140 acres of land, which would be Bruce's land under the 2001 deeds, that Bruce would continue to rent that for 2 years after his dad died. This is in 2003, so Lloyd knew full well at the time that this was Bruce's 140 acres. What possible purpose for including language in that lease agreement that Bruce would continue to rent his own land, unless Lloyd truly intended to take that 140 acres as well, consistent with Exhibit 8, where he represents to Dale Strasser that he needs help or would like help selling 220 acres that are not in his name. Again, that did not find its way into the findings of fact or the conclusions of law. There was also, it's a small example, but...
There were no findings that I recall as to delivery of, but it wasn't an issue as to delivery of deeds to anyone other than to Lloyd, was it? That wasn't part of the quiet title action.
May I continue and answer your question? I see my time is expired.
Sure, go ahead.
The question is whether or not it mattered to anyone else in terms of delivery other than Lloyd prior to 2004.
If that was an issue in the hearing, that wasn't part of the matter decided by the court, was it?
As to when delivery was completed?
To anyone other than Lloyd.
No, but that brings up an interesting question because Lloyd's power of attorney, which is Exhibit 10, did not give him the ability to complete gifts. And to me, this is another curious piece of Lloyd's testimony from 2001, is he's saying, well, these deeds were delivered to me in 2001, even though his brothers didn't learn about the deeds at all until late November of 2004. And again, how can there be effective delivery to him if his dad gives him three deeds, two of which are not his, and he does not have the ability as the power of attorney to complete delivery of the other two? I think that speaks to Cecil Sr.'s intent at the time that, in fact, he did not intend to give these three deeds to him in September of 2001, but intended to hold them for tax reasons.
Your time has expired. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Parsons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Mr. Nichols. Jane Smiley wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel called 1,000 Acres that dealt with an aging patriarch of an Iowa farm family and how the land that he accumulated over the years might be distributed among competing siblings. In this case, we have a patriarch, Cecil Stockwell Sr., and we have about 1,000 acres that he was entitled to distribute as he saw fit. And we have competing siblings, brothers in this case, all of whom received substantial land and financial assistance from their father over the course of their lifetimes, but only one of whom, Lloyd Stockwell, accepted their father's offer in 1985 to become his partner and farmed with him for almost 20 years. And interestingly, we also have a published author in this case, Judge Bjorkman, who recently wrote a well-received book of historical nonfiction. And this case also involves, as Mr. Nichols said, historical facts that have been settled by his decision, unless they're clearly erroneous. And Judge Bjorkman, as the trier of fact and the finder of fact in this case, carefully listened to all the sworn testimony, saw everyone on the stand, observed their demeanor, and judged what was to be believed about what happened. And his extremely detailed factual findings, I would suggest, are soundly supported by the evidence. And there's no suggestion that he made any errors of law.
Now, Mr. Nichols would take this case out of the norm by saying that there are no disputed facts. It's only this court's obligation to determine what the law is based on undisputed facts. Do you accept that?
Well, I accept that if we accept the judge's findings as the facts in this case, I'm perfectly happy to do that. And I think those are the correct factual findings. And when you look at those undisputed facts, it's clear, as Judge Bjorkman found, that there was a delivery in 2001. It was based on factual testimony, supported by Lloyd Stockwell, who was on the stand, Lynn Stockwell, who was on the stand, and Tom Johnson, attorney Tom Johnson, who was on the stand. What the testimony was that in 2001, to skip to that main point, in 2001, after Cecil and Lloyd had been farming together for many years, he had previously recorded warranty deeds, or not recorded, but issued warranty deeds that gave the land he owned to all four sons. And those were executed in 1992. And when he did that, as Attorney Dale Strasser testified, at that time, when there's no suggestion at all that he would be impaired in any way, he decided he would give most of the land to Lloyd, with whom he had farmed for all that time. And he issued four warranty deeds, signed and executed them. They were never delivered, but he signed and executed them. They gave Lloyd about almost 600 of the 1,000 acres. And they gave about 300 to Bruce. They gave about 160 acres to John. And they gave 80 acres to Cecil. Now, he never delivered those, and they were never recorded, so they were never effective. But in 2001, he decided, well, now is the time I'm going to deliver my deeds. So what he did, according to the testimony that was accepted by Judge Bjorkman, is he asked Lynn, who was Lloyd's wife, because Cecil couldn't type. He asked Lynn to type up these new 2001 warranty deeds. Over the course of a couple of nights, he largely from memory dictated all of his property and who he wanted it to go to of the four sons. And she would type it up, and he would make the corrections and give them back, and she would retype it. I think they went through three versions. She didn't understand how land was delineated, and she didn't understand what his holdings were in terms of that. So we know that he understood pretty much precisely what land he owned at that time and who he wanted it to go to. And he wanted it essentially to go to the same sons in the same fashion that his 1992 deeds that were never recorded had sought to do, with two changes. First change was that John no longer was going to receive the 160 acres that he was going to receive under the 1991 deeds. And there was a very specific reason for that. John, Cecil had given a lot of land to his other sons over the years, not just land, but financial assistance, helping them buy land, and gifts of land or sales of land for, much less than it was worth, that were in effect gifts. And Cecil had given a lot of land to John, and John, without ever telling Cecil earlier, prior to this, had sold it. And Cecil found out that this land that he took such pride in, he'd accumulated over all these years and wanted to remain Stockwell land, was going to be sold at auction. And they read it in the newspaper. And this emotionally devastated Cecil. And he went in his room and he came out red-faced and as though he'd been crying. And he attended the auction and, he actually talked about trying to stop it, but of course he couldn't. And he swore, that day, the testimony was that John was not going to get any more of his land. And so that 160 acres was taken out in the 2001 deeds. And then there was one other change. An 80-acre parcel that was going to go to Bruce was instead given to Lloyd. And that there was a very specific reason for that as well. One, there had been a business dispute between Bruce and John, and his father. That had left some hard feelings. But the other was, as the testimony was, even from Lloyd's grandchild who testified at trial, was that they were on that land one day, and his grandchildren were talking about where they would like to build their homes. And they said, well, I'd like to build my home right over there. And Cecil, as the testimony was, that said, well, then we'll have to make some changes, and I'll make sure you get that land. And so that 80 acres was shifted. So the difference between the 1992 deeds and the difference between the 2001 deeds is about a 15% difference. And it's just that 160 acres or so that was changed. The divesting of John and the slight reduction in land that was given to Bruce. And so all this, in order to reject the finding, let me proceed then to the circumstances of the delivery. Then in 2001, after these new deeds were typed up without any involvement by Lloyd. Cecil asked Lloyd to take him to town so they could record these. And he wanted, or not record these, but execute them. So they went to town, they went to the bank, and they were notarized. Cecil signed them. And then the testimony was, Cecil handed them to Lloyd and said, here you go. And Lloyd took them, and they were put in his dresser back at his home. And Judge Gerpen made a specific finding that they both understood at that point that the deeds had been delivered, in that sense, to Lloyd.
You know, I didn't understand if that was Lloyd's dresser or Cecil's dresser.
It was owned by Lloyd. It ended up in Cecil's room that Lloyd had built for him in his house. Cecil lived with Lloyd for about 7 years at the end of his life.
Or were they Lloyd's papers that were kept there, or Cecil's papers?
Both of their papers were kept there, Lloyd's and Cecil's. So there is, you know, that's where they kept the farm papers. And they were business partners. They had been partners for, you know, since 1985. They paid the bills together. They took their losses together. They made their profits together. And they were co-signed on Cecil's debt. Lloyd co-signed all of Cecil's debt. And so we have this delivery, and in order to reject that, you would have to find that Lloyd Stockwell was not telling the truth on the stand, and that Lynn Warren was not telling the truth, and that Tom Johnson was not telling the truth on the stand about his explanations here. And they made these arguments in front of Judge Bjorkman, and Judge Bjorkman heard this testimony, and he didn't buy it. He didn't buy it at all, these suppositions and, you know, character attacks that were presented. The trial court resolved those against the appellants.
How do you factor in these five exhibits that counsel says the court just simply didn't deal with?
I don't factor them in, frankly,
well,
Your Honor.
You factor them out then?
Yeah, I factor them out because they really aren't telling. You know, they're not very material. In order to reach the conclusions that the appellants want this court to find on appeal, you have to pile supposition upon supposition and interpret them in ways that I don't interpret them in that way. You know, the exhibit that Mr. Nichols led off with, where after his father was sued by his three sons to try to force him out of Lloyd's home where he wanted to be and force him into a nursing home, you know, that made Lloyd angry. And it made Cecil extremely angry. Cecil didn't want to talk to his sons for a long time after that. And he wrote a letter, you know, expressing his frustration. And his frustration was this. You know, Cecil retained a life estate in these lands. And Lloyd had co-signed onto all of Cecil's debt and was making payments on the debt together out of the business profits, the farm profits. And so there was frustration that his brothers, who weren't really pitching a hand and taking care of his father and who didn't want to farm with his father when they had the opportunity to do so, they were trying to disrupt his father's life and his life. And so there was frustration there. The thing about renting Bruce's land, how that, you know, the land that the warranty deed would give to Bruce, that's somehow probative. The reason it had to be rented to Bruce was because Cecil had a life estate. I mean, it's as simple as that. So these suppositions from what they're asserting about tax liability and you know, a statement in a letter here and a memo there, all this was presented to Judge Bjorkman, and Judge Bjorkman heard all of the explanations about all of those documents from all of the witnesses, and he rejected all of the contentions made by the appellants. And so what we have here is a delivery at a time when even Mr. Nichols here pretty much concedes that there was no diminished capacity in 2001. I mean, he forgot a few things. That's about the best they can do, is come up with a couple of things he forgot, you know, in years prior to that. We have a delivery, and we have a finding that he was had sufficient capacity. He understood his property. He dictated it from memory almost. He knew he felt very strong-willed. I mean, this land was as dear to Cecil Stockwell as anything in his life. I mean, this is what his life had been collecting this land, and he wanted it to be Stockwell land, he wanted it to be farmland, and he wanted to ensure that what he had built continued on for generations, and this is the way that he saw fit to do that. As Dale Strasser testified, Cecil had told him in 1992. And we have...
All right, in 1992, when the deeds were prepared, and it's your contention that the deeds were really testamentary type documents, as I recall, Dean Strasser prepared a will?
Yes.
Does that go to any of the presumptions on where the land, because isn't that where we go back to? Is back to that will if that, all these deeds are thrown out?
That may be well what happens, and that would make Cecil roll over in his grave if that would happen. Basically, the will was issued in 1975 at a time when he was farming with John, way back when. And the will essentially gave everything to John. And that will was never revoked, as I understand it. I mean, we haven't had a trial on any of those issues, but as I understand it, that will was never revoked. And so when he went to Mr. Strasser in 1992, he said, I want to make sure I understand where my land is going. And Strasser advised him to do these warranty deeds. And so the warranty deeds gave the land to all four sons in the amounts that I described, with, again, most of it going to Lloyd. If you hold that none of these warranty deeds were effective, there's a possibility it would go back to everything, the land would go to John. And John is the one that he intentionally said, I would not want to have any more of my land, and the one he divested in 2001 deeds, because the land he had already given him free and clear, he had sold. And so that would go against everything we know about Cecil's wishes. The issue of undue influence, again, there's no evidence of undue influence. Being close with your father, farming with him, taking care of him is not something that's illegitimate or inappropriate or undue. It's natural that the son that he farmed this very land with for 20 years and the son who took care of him would receive a larger percentage of it. That's a natural thing. It's entirely logical. And under undue influence, the test is, for influence to be undue, it must be of such a character as to destroy the free agency of the grantor and substitute the will of another for that of the grantor. And again, Cecil Sr.'s will was not destroyed here. It was honored. So I would respectfully suggest that Judge Bjorkman arrived at the appropriate conclusion to this unfortunate family saga.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Nichols, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I want to talk specifically of findings of fact 122. Actually, 121 and 120 also. In there, Judge Bjorkman indicates that Cecil Jr. and Lloyd were around the dinner table, and Geraldine Warren comes downstairs and announces in the paper that John was selling this land, and Cecil cried. The problem is that the trial court accepted that as fact, but on page 232 of volume 2 of the trial, in 247, Cecil Jr. says, I was not there. Cecil Jr. also says, I went to the sale, but my dad was out of it by then. He didn't know what was going on. This is in 2000. And this forms the basis for the belief that this 80 acres that John had under the 92 deeds were taken from him because Cecil Sr. was so mad at him. Justice Severson, I want to address a point that you made about the 1975 will that Justice Sabers prepared, actually. Under the probate code, there's also statutes that allow you to prove up a gift by clear and convincing evidence. And we do have the 92 deeds, which I think are some evidence of what Cecil Sr. intended. In my mind, the big leap then is how 9 years later does 160 acres end up in Lloyd's hands. And again, if we look at some of these exhibits, the fact that Lloyd was writing checks out of his dad's account for his own benefit, Exhibit 87, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Parsons. The lease on its face in 2003 indicates that Bruce is going to continue paying for 2 more years after Cecil dies. clearly states that, and it was language added in 2003. The second page of Exhibit 87 is the lease from the prior year, and it has no such language whatsoever. So in my mind, that exhibit clearly shows Lloyd's intent to self-deal. In 1992, there was a letter deal where Cecil Sr. invited all of his boys to look at this farmland he wanted to buy and go into operation with all four of them. Lloyd put his foot down at the time and said, "Dad, that's not going to happen." Bruce testified at length that from 92 on, Lloyd was absolutely running the show. Dale Strasser testified that Lloyd sat through all of the meetings. The legal bills went to Lloyd. Lloyd was really the one running the farm show after 92. Judge Bjorkman found that Cecil Sr. was a strong-willed man. While that very well might have been true in the 70s and the 80s, after 92, Lloyd put his heel down and he was running the show. Cecil Sr. was not the strong-willed man. Every day in the state, usually once a week, a trial court instructs a jury on what is evidence. And we refer to evidence as being the same, whether it's direct or circumstantial evidence. And we're not to make any distinction between the two, but in reality, when it comes to the trial courts, we do tend to put more stock in direct evidence, which is a huge burden in estate cases like this, where we weren't there in 2001 when these deeds were delivered. All we have to rely on is the circumstantial evidence that says something here doesn't smell right. And I think that's, look at these exhibits. I want to speak about Exhibit 81, which the trial court refused. It was a recording that Bruce made. Conclusion of law number 50 says that Lloyd took no part in preparing these deeds. Exhibit 81, Lloyd says on there that he talked to his dad for 9 months beforehand and begged his dad not to change the deeds because he was so mad at John. And the trial court refused that exhibit as a settlement discussion. I want to speak to SDCL 19-12-10. When it talks about settlement discussion, it says you can't get into that stuff to show liability. There was no admission of liability on Exhibit 81. However, there were a number of contradictory statements made by Lloyd as to how these deeds were prepared, the tax implications, his motivation. When we talk about a lack of evidence that we can't dispute that in 2001 this isn't exactly what happened, I mean, there's circumstantial evidence all over the place in the record in form of exhibits, which this court can review de novo. And I just don't know how you get around or reconcile the fact that Lloyd's telling his brother, "Well, I was talking to Dad about it," and then he testifies in court, "I had no participation in this." If you look at Exhibits 1 through 3 and compare them to Exhibits 56, you can even see that deeds that Gerald and Warren had previously prepared are different than the deeds that are in 1 through 3. There's a premeditated blank left for the county where these will be notarized. So it suggests that they were going to a discrete location to have these deeds notarized. Also, Judge Bjorkman found that in paragraph 165 of his findings of fact that the lady who notarized these deeds were Lloyd's cousin. Well, actually what Lloyd testified to was that she was her third cousin and he had never talked to her before. And so those are some of the concerns that I have about accepting one version's side of the story over another and not getting into the meat of these exhibits that we have that have a lot of circumstantial evidence that there are problems here. Another thing that strikes me as odd is the trial court found that this Grass Lake transaction that took place in 1995 was an intended gift to Bruce Stockwell. But then Lloyd says, well, the reason that the 80 acres in the 92 deed were not included to Bruce in the 2001 deed because Dad was mad at him over this combining operation and he cheated him. Well, why did he give him this gift in 95 on the Grass Lake transaction? And if you look at Exhibit 43, Tom Johnson's notes on page 25 indicates, and Lloyd describes to Tom Johnson, Bruce as a hard worker and honest. So how do you reconcile the fact that he's supposedly cheating his brother?
Well, isn't that the trial court's job to reconcile that? Don't we get back to that?
And that's the heart of the issue in this case, is to what extent those facts, you need to give deference to the trial court. But I think if that First National case talking about de novo review of exhibits has any meaning at all, this is a case that it must be applied because we have so many exhibits here that contradict Lloyd's version of things, and they need to be addressed and explained. The other thing that I found really troubling, we talk about Lloyd's testimony as to how his deeds came about and when they were delivered. The trial court felt that delivery was a term of art and that Lloyd didn't really understand the legal implications of it. But I asked him twice in his deposition, and they were read into the record at trial, about delivery of the deeds in 2004. And I used those words, 2004, because it was a foregone conclusion at that point. That's when delivery happened. And he looked at me and answered my question without saying, oh, it was 2001 or anything like that. To me, delivery means delivery. When did you get these? There was much talk about the fact that, and I know Justice Zinner, you had a question about whose dresser this was and whose papers these were. What's interesting is at the trial court level and his deposition and even his interrogatory answer, Lloyd has always maintained that he really did not have a lot of access to these, and looked at the total of 5 minutes between 2001 and 2004, which I think is a significant piece of evidence in regard to who had control of those deeds in that three-year window. Maybe other farm papers of Lloyd's were kept there, but the suggestion was I maybe looked at them for 5 minutes. But then again, we have this Exhibit 81 that was not received, indicating a whole other version of how the deeds were prepared, who prepared them. And again, I think if you look at Exhibits 1 through 3 and 56 and compare them, you see a lot of interesting peculiarities. One of the things that is, I think, really telling is Gerald and Warren testified that these deeds were prepared over 2 months on that Cecil Sr. fly spectrum and had her make changes. Exhibits 3 and 5 are Cecil Jr.'s 80 acres. They are identical. Why would, using the 92 deed as a template, it take three times over 2 months to recreate that deed when on its face it's the same as the 92 deed? And we also have the whole idea of someone who is not remembering that their own brother died, could not remember his son John because of his shaved mustache or shut in, not participating in news, looking over and flyspecking these deeds without any of Lloyd's assistance. Well, my time is running short. Again, I would urge the court to apply the First National case. Look at Exhibits 81, 82, 83, 87, self-dealing. Exhibit 18, 8, you look at those, and I think you can see that the trial court erred in accepting Lloyd's version of the evidence over my client's version of the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.